Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 21st, 2004. Today's session number is BUK 2004-01. Today's speaker is Kent Burgess. The lesson for today is Vocation, Leadership, and Governance. Stumbling into vocation, not wanting to be there. Let's listen in.
We're going to start this session, and I think they're about 5 minutes late for dinner, so we won't wait 5 minutes. We'll just go ahead and get started. My name is Kent Burgess, and kind of the summer theme here at Holden, the summer theme is Summon Out What We Shall Be. I think that theme is probably all about vocation, calling, how we live our lives, who we are. Actually, this week I was scheduled to be the village philosopher, and that's really a great job because nobody really knows what it is. And they really don't call to do anything, and they comp your stay. So I readily agreed to be the village philosopher, and then received a fax from Janet last week saying, could you do some things on the summer theme? I wasn't going to say no to Holden, so I said, yeah, I'll do a couple sessions. Didn't know what they would be, but then my wife kindly drove all the way from Billings, Montana, out here so that I could actually kind of work on some sessions. Today's going to be kind of fun, I think, because I'm going to tell you nursing home stories. So if you're looking for something other than nursing home stories, this might be a good time to go. As we were driving out from Billings, and I was talking to Linda about the theme, and I said, calling, vocation, and she said, what do you know about that? I mean, for the last 28 years, you've been trying to figure out what you want to do when you grow up. So I thought that kind of made me intimately qualified to talk about this. Really, the theme for me is that I became a nursing home administrator when I was 22. I've always worked for the Lutheran Church, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I ended up there. But kind of the theme for me is that's not where I wanted to be. I don't think probably most of you would hold that up as a high calling or vocation. I actually know one of the co-directors, Diane, from another life. When she was also involved with the Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Society. And when you're at parties and people ask you, what you do, you said nursing home administrator, they kind of glance away and look down. Usually the conversation would just kind of end there. Actually this is probably a session done better over a couple of glasses of wine because the stories get even better then. But I have found, frankly, a great gladness in doing that. Nursing homes are much like Holden Village. They're really appreciative audiences. You don't have to be real good, and people, like you and applaud you, especially if they haven't heard or seen anything else for a long time. Nursing homes are a place that have been very, very nurturing to me. I'm going to do two more sessions that will be a little bit more serious than this one. Today I'm kind of hoping just to tell you some stories and then maybe invite folks to talk a little bit about their own sense of calling and vocation or share some of their own stories. Tomorrow I'll move from talking about individually to corporately. And talk a little bit, my session tomorrow is entitled The 5+ Reasons I'll Never Serve on the Church Council Again. The reason it's 5+ is I started out with 5, but every time I do it, I add another one. And I think tomorrow I'll be up to 9. But what we're really going to talk about is governance, and what we're really going to talk about is poor governance. And then the hope and the reason that we talk about that is that we can maybe talk about good governance and good kind of corporate leadership, especially in the church as a whole. And then on Friday, I'm going to try to build and talk a little bit about what I think is the strong link between faith and leadership. I think a lot of people see a tremendous disconnect between We talk about, there's a lot of really faithful people. They tend to be really bad leaders. There tends to be a lot of really good leaders. They tend not to be very faithful people. I just don't think that disconnect should be there. And I think we need to kind of turn the pyramid upside down and look at it a little bit differently. And I'm actually going to try to build on some stuff that I think Barbara will probably be doing tomorrow or Wednesday morning when she talks about lamb power. And rather than talking a little bit about servant leadership, I'll talk a little bit about serving leadership, and that will be on Friday. Thinking a little bit about discerning vocation, and I'm sure you all are doing all the stuff you really want to do, but I was trying to think about, how we kind of end up doing what we do and how comfortable we get with it. It seems like the clearest one would be that God comes and knocks on our door and taps us on the shoulder and tells us what we're going to do. That would be really clear, but as I read most of the biblical stories where that happened, the people that had that call weren't really that happy about that. It seems the second way is to for us to take a battery of tests. Over my life, I've taken all sorts of tests. From personality tests to a series of questions where they took the questions and how you answered them and then matched them up with people who were really happy doing what they did. And if you answered the questions like the happy people were doing theirs, then maybe that was a good fit for you. Those tests have never really worked out for me. If you're familiar with the personality test like the Myers-Briggs, every time I take it, and I've taken it three times, I come out as an introvert, and I keep ending up in extroverted jobs. That hasn't worked for me. The other, I think, is the discernment of others. Michael talked a little bit about, in his last session, about friends and colleagues who were able to kind of help him discern where he was to be in his life. We used to do a lot of that here at Holden. I actually lived here for 4 years as the business manager. Especially amongst the long-term staff, we would often gather people in this room that knew us well to talk about what we were going to be when we left here. It was often a conversation about what we were going to be and be about when we left here. And so it was people who had lived very intimately, very closely with you, that you had a lot of levels of kind of trust and honesty with, who would tell you what they thought your strengths were and would share with you what they thought your weaknesses were and where they thought maybe your gifts would serve in the world. So I think the discernment of others. Some people are just born into it, others get lucky and just fall into it. But my preferred route has been to figure out what I'm not good at. So I just keep trying to do things, and then when I figure out I'm not good at that, then I figure that's not my calling. The great philosopher that I listened to driving over, Willie Nelson, had this, whatever I was meant to be, sooner or later it will come to me. I thought that was kind of meaningful for me. So I'm just going to kind of share with you some stories that kind of kept me grounded and rooted in long-term care, and then just kind of open it up to you a little bit. I told you I was going to start by trying to do things that I wasn't very good at. So when I was going to college, I had to make money. And I decided one year that I was going to paint houses because it looked like that you could make a lot of money painting houses, and it didn't look like it was that hard. So I put a little ad in the paper. I'd never painted anything in my life, and this family actually hired me to paint their house and wanted a bid. I kind of figured out, I didn't know how much paint, I figured it out. And I forget what it was. It was something like $800. This would have been probably about 1973. It was in Boise, Idaho, and it was hot. It was probably 110 degrees, and I painted this house all by myself, and it was a lot of work. And they wanted it done with oil paint, so I used the oil paint. It was so hot, all the oil paint blistered. So I had to come back in the evenings and the mornings and scrape off everything I had done and repaint it again. So I made this money, and I forget, but I actually made a profit on the deal and then proceeded to not paint another house that summer. As I rolled into the school year for the coming year, I realized I didn't have enough money to return to college. I didn't want to paint houses, and I needed a part-time job. And so I looked in the paper, and the local nursing home, it was called the Boise Valley Sunset Home, had an ad for a part-time activities director. And given that I had no real skills, I thought that might be a good job for me. And so I actually went and applied, and I think they were a bit in shock because I don't think a male had ever applied for that job. I was interviewed by a variety of folks and ultimately hired as the part-time activities director while I was going to school. The big thing in the early 70s in nursing homes was this therapy. They called it reality orientation. What are you laughing about? And anyway, so this has actually come out of the VA hospital in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And it was my job to take really severely demented and confused people and have them sit in a little just like this, and I'm actually having to practice on it. And this was actually, they gave me, an entire, 4 hours worth of training, which is probably 2 hours more than this job really took. But so I went into a day room, and the nurse's aides brought these people in. And there, I actually had five. I can remember five the first time. And I would sit in a chair in front of them, and I'd have this big board. It wasn't as big as the whiteboard, but it was a big board. And it had things on it that said, like, today is, what is today?
Monday.
Today is Monday. Can you say Monday?
Monday.
And then the weather out is sunny. The next holiday is the 4th of July. And of course, the five people are looking at me just like the five of you. just sitting there. And of course, the goal was back then is that we were going to take these kind of confused folks and we were going to bring them into reality with us. Because it was really important. If we would just reinforce the year, the month, and the day, that this was going to bring them back into reality. As I sat there, I did my first class, I think it was the third day on the job, and the nurse's aides were all kind of gathered in the doorway, and just kind of watched. One, they thought it was kind of weird, this guy here and doing this, and I'll be a bit graphic here, but it's the truth. As I was saying, today is Monday, one of the ladies stood up, lifted her skirt, and went number two, right in front of me. I guess that was her reality. And my reality didn't really matter. And I didn't say a word. I was looking over there. Three nurses' aides, they weren't going to come and help me. I thought, okay, you're not going to beat me down. I put my board down. I excused myself for a minute. I went and asked where I could get a mop and a bucket, and I cleaned that up. But I thought, this I don't think this is building upon my skills. And I seem to have a fair amount of freedom in this job. I seem to have really actually a lot of freedom in this job. I was kind of lucky, like many of you. My parents got me started in music early. Unfortunately, I quit at the end of the sixth grade, but my parents rented me a plastic Bundy clarinet, and I took clarinet lessons in the fifth and sixth grade, and I kind of did sports, so that was the length of my musical career. But actually, I had a book, and it was full of songs that were kind of like songs that older folks would like, Let Me Call You Sweetheart, and I actually found that I could still play them. And as I got to meet the residents of this place, I found all these kind of hidden talents, kind of like you do at Holden. And I found that there was this 90-year-old guy, his name was Hank, and he played the drums, or had played the drums. He hadn't played them for years. Now, it was a problem, because Hank was deaf. But he said he could play the drums, and so I found somebody to donate a kind of drum set. And then I found this lady, and she was quite elderly, but she could play the piano. She could actually play pretty well. She couldn't see. She was blind. But if you kind of gave her the song, and she could figure it out, and she'd start playing. And she could kind of move from whatever key my little fifth grade band book was in. And so we kind of found out that we formed a little band. And I was thinking it was kind of cool that, you know, what I really wanted to do was start a bar in this nursing home. And I found this kind of little library space that was never utilized at all. And I asked if I could kind of maybe do a little happy hour in there, and I got permission from everyone to allow me to do that. And I've never touched a sewing machine in my life, but I found a bunch of ladies who could sew, and I asked them to make me a little red and white checkered tablecloths. And I got the little square tables in there, and I put the little red and white checkered tablecloths in there, and I got a piano in there, and I got the drums set up, and I got a little budget from administration to buy some beer and some wine, and I put up some signs, and I advertised this kind of evening social hour that would begin about 4. So I had everybody set up, and we started, and back then you could smoke in nursing homes. I mean, you could smoke everywhere. So this little tiny room, you know, people were sitting at the table and they were smoking, and I had beer and wine, and I was trying to play my clarinet, and Hank was deaf, but he could hear the thump of the piano enough that he was figuring out where to go, and she was playing the piano, and I was trying to help people in and get in and out of chairs and open up and get them a wine and get them a beer, and you know, it was seemed to be going pretty well to me, and it got really smoky in there. And then, you know, I kind of somewhere along the line lost control. I was on the floor. This was actually a very, very large nursing home, and the nurse that was in charge of that, and I still remember her name today, Barbara McAllister. And if you've seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I was pretty suspect to begin with. But as far as I can tell, people were having a good time. And we were going through a lot of beer and wine, and it was kind of time to go to dinner. It's like they, you know, rang the bell and people would line up at the door. Well, nobody would leave. And then I kind of came to realize about 7 or 8 of them were just totally smashed. And they couldn't get out of their chairs. And they weren't going to dinner. And so I had to kind of go get the nurse and the nurse's aides and kind of explain that I kind of lost control. Barbara McAllister was yelling and screaming at me. And I was trying to put people back to bed. They weren't going to dinner that night. Needless to say, the next day I was informed that my little bar had been closed down. And we wouldn't be doing that any longer. I was disappointed, but not thwarted. So I noticed that a lot of the folks in the home didn't have great personal grooming, and you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, great personal grooming. And I especially noticed that in the case of a lot of the men who had, you know, kind of hair growing out of everywhere and needed haircuts. And so I had this kind of cool idea that I'd open up a barber shop. And I found this bathhouse in the nursing home. It was never used. They never used this bathhouse, and I got permission. And fortunately, it was on Barbara McAllister's floor again. But I got permission to open this barbershop. And at the time, Linda and I were dating, and she's an artist. And I got her to make me one of those red and white barber poles that went around. And so she made me this big barber pole, and I set it outside the bathhouse. And then I got clippers. I got this people to donate me this old barber chair, this old-fashioned barber chair. And I got several volunteers to come and help me haul it into this bathhouse. And then I thought, you know, for it to work really well, we probably need some cigars. And actually, I'm probably going to get in trouble here, but I had cigars and Playboys. I got it all set up, so I had red, you know, hot towels and wet towels, and I had it lined up, and I had, and so I'd get the guys in there. I'd get 3 or 4 guys in there, and I'd let them read the magazines, and we'd smoke cigars, and the problem was I didn't have a barber. But I was kind of looking at it. It didn't look like it was going to be that hard to me. So I thought, you know, I could trim up some of these folks. This wasn't, and I got to be pretty good at it. If you don't know, I cut my own hair. I cut my own hair now. It's not that hard. So I was doing pretty good, you know, and people seemed, and it went on for several days, and it was going pretty good. I had the barbershop open like on, you know, Monday and Wednesday afternoons, and the guys were reading magazines and smoking cigars, and I was talking back and forth, and some people were pretty talkative, and others weren't. Men seemed to really like kind of hanging in there. And then the nurse's aide started bringing me people because I was doing a pretty darn good job there. So I had this one gentleman, and I still remember his name today. His name was Bill Woodman. And he was one of those people I would have had in the reality orientation class earlier. So he didn't really say anything, but he would get in the chair, and I would trim up his hair. And he had, you know, those really bushy, you know, bushy eyebrows and those big... his wrinkles in his eyelids and hair coming out of his ears. And I kept looking at him and thinking I could just do a little bit better job all the time. And I'm talking to guys, and I'm thinking I'll trim up his eyebrows a little bit. And I'm talking to guys. And I look back, and there's blood gushing from his eye. I poked out the guy's eye. And I get a towel, and I get this wet towel, and I get it on, and I clean up his face, and I'm realizing that, no, his eyeball's fine, but if I pull his eyelid down, I'd caught one of those little folds, and it was like paper dolls, and so I could see in there, and you know, the guy didn't say a word, didn't flinch, didn't say a word. So I go out, and the first nurse I run into is Barbara McAllister. I invite her to come to the barber shop. Anyway, they get him fixed up, and then the administrator decides that there's major liability questions here. So they close down my barbershop. Barbara McAllister informs me that I'm going to have to call Bill's wife and explain what happened. And I did, and she was a very, very nice lady. And very thankful for the things that I had been trying to do, and said that, you know, she seemed like I was an energetic young man, maybe not a very bright one, and was very, very appreciative of it. That's kind of the end of that story, but I also I taught a ceramics class. I learned how to do ceramics, and we would, you know, we'd sell ceramics just so we'd get enough money to buy more ceramics, to do more ceramics. And I pulled, back then I had this 1967 lime green Mustang, the springs were gone, and it wasn't an automatic, it wasn't really a very nice car, but I thought it was kind of cool. And then I'd pull it up, I found a secret little place, I could park it right off the activities room there of the nursing home. And I wore glasses then, and I only wore the glasses to drive or to go to movies. That was back then, it was the only time I wore glasses. So when I was done driving, I'd just take my glasses and I'd throw them on the dash of the vehicle. One day, it's the end of the day, and I go to go home, and I get in my car, and I'm wet. I mean, I'm wet everywhere. I'm wet, and it smells like urine. And it's soaking through. And I reach up, and my glasses are gone. So my glasses are gone, and something happened in the seat of my car. So I go back in the nursing home. I'm going down the hallway, and Mr. Woodman's walking down the hallway. And I notice that he's wet all over. And then I look at him, and he's wearing glasses. Well, remember, I cut his eyebrows, and he doesn't wear glasses. And Mr. Woodman had my glasses on. So I just assumed that he had went to my car, tried to leave, didn't find any keys, put my glasses on, had an accident, but it felt like payback for the barbershop. I just got to tell you, I had a lot of fun. I made a lot of mistakes back then, but for some reason, the people of this Lutheran home thought that somewhere I had this heart, and somewhere in that period of time, I went from being a full-time student and a part-time activities director to a full-time activities director and a part-time student, because it was the one place I just show up, and I didn't have to do a lot to seem to make a difference. And it was the one place in my life, and I'd had a pretty blessed life, with a great family, but it was the one place I'd show up, and when I'd leave at the end of the day, I really liked who I was. I thought, I never wanted to be a nursing home administrator. And 28 years later, I'm still kind of doing that. I'm going to just shift gears one and then invite you to kind of tell some of your stories. Ultimately, the administrator of this place, who I had done all these things to, said, our the Good Samaritan Society has an administrative internship, and would you be interested in doing an internship? And you'll do a one-year administrative internship, and then we'll place you somewhere. Our organization will, and I was kind of eager, and about that time Linda and I had gotten married, and so I did this internship, and at the end of the internship, they said, we have three homes open. And one is in Duluth, Minnesota, one is in Albion, Nebraska, and the other one is in Arlington, Ohio. And I had hardly ever been out of the state of Idaho in my life, so Linda and I got out a map and kind of a ruler and figured out that Arlington, Ohio was the farthest away from Idaho, and so that must be the reason we ought to go there. And so I went, and so much for discernment. I went there, and for some reason it was just the right place for me. It was this little 50-bed Lutheran nursing home, this little farming community of 1,200 people, 14 miles south of Findlay, Ohio. And when I got there at the age of 22, I found out that I was the youngest employee. I was the administrator, I was the boss, but I was the youngest employee. There really wasn't much for me to do there, to be really honest. Every department manager had been there the entire 8 years the place had been opened. The place fundamentally ran itself. So they gave me really important jobs, like they let me plant the flowers in front of the nursing home. And then they also decided that it would be really good maybe if I passed the mail. Most of the time, 3 to 4 days out of the week, I would pass the mail, and I got pretty good at it. What was really nice is that a lot of the residents wanted me to read their mail to them, and so because they couldn't read it or couldn't see it, so I would read their mail, 3 or 4 times a week. Of course, again, I was a pretty energetic guy, and I was starting my faith journey at that point. And to be real honest, this was kind of my introduction to any sense of kind of faith. I was really committed that this was going to be a Lutheran home. So I kept asking the question, what does it mean to be a Christian place? And I wanted to be this Christian place. And then the Good Samaritan Society came out with this kind of program they called, I don't know, Diane, if you remember, the Workers' Witness Program. And it was Lutheran pastors, Jacob Gerstedt's concept that we would train our staff to be witnesses for Christ. And we would get them all little pocket testaments, and they would carry their pocket testaments with them. So I got all fired up about this. And we had about 50 employees, so we got 50 pocket testaments. I developed this really nice speech, and I'd give the staff, I'd bring the staff in, and I'd say, this is a gift from God. And this gift is as only as good as you use it. And what we're asking is that you take this book, and you stick it in the smock, pocket of your smock, and you look for somebody today who seems a little down, or that God seems far away. And you read to them from this. And that's going to make us a Christian place. So I get, they all stared at me, pretty much like the five people in the alley. Put the little Bibles in their smock pockets, and as far as I could tell, nobody ever read anything to anybody. So then I started to ask questions, and you know, fundamentally kind of came down to there, you know, Kent, I wouldn't know where to find anything in here if I could. You know, I mean, I'm not much of a biblical scholar. I started to find out people really kind of afraid. Really, in some ways, kind of afraid. I mean, have you ever asked, you know, people who don't do Bible study, to do Bible study? They don't want to do Bible study. So that, so I went out and got the Ready Reference Guide for your pocket testament. it became my great theological training ground because it had like the ABCs of salvation. For the first time, I understood salvation. It was in an ABC format. There was a whole section on here on the, you know, what to read when God seems far away, when God seems distant, when somebody seems sorrowful, told you right where to go. So we handed out the pocket testaments. One day I came to work, well, there was this lady, several people, I'm looking at Barb and Linda, and I think Dan's heard this story. I think I used this in a sermon 2 years ago.
I was going to ask you to tell it if you want.
Oh, okay. I just realized that. There was this one lady, you know, I have to admit that there were favorites. People became favorites. I became closer to certain people. And there was this one lady, and her name was Laura Potter, and she was just this kind of cool old lady. And she had this, she in her room, and the rooms weren't very big in the nursing home, but she had this big boxy, I called this old person's chair. I mean, it was this huge boxy chair, and she was just this little woman. And she would sit in this chair, and her arms would be up here, in this big chair. And they brought this chair in from the farm out in Hardin County. And Laura was totally blind. But that wasn't really what had brought her. She actually was living in the home that her father had lived in. It had been their kind of lifelong homestead farm. But then she developed just terrible arthritis. And it was very painful for her to kind of move in any way, shape, or form. So it was really the arthritis and not the blindness that brought her out there. I would take her mail, and she was this great lady. And like all great people get great mail. So I loved to read her mail to her. And then she had a granddaughter who came in, who was about my age, early 20s, who had two little kids. And she would bring these, who had been Laura's great-grandchildren. And she would come and visit her grandmother almost every day. And then she brought, you know, and I actually remember them. They were Lincoln Logs. If people remember Lincoln Logs. And Tinker Toys. Those were kind of the two sets of toys. And Laura would sit in her chair, and the granddaughter would dump the Tinker Toys and Lincoln Logs on the floor, and the two little kids would play at the great-grandmother's feet while the granddaughter sat on the hospital bed next to the big chair. And the granddaughter brought three things. I just kind of learned this was three great things. Well, first of all, she brought like a U.S. News and World Report magazine. She would read a little bit to her grandmother about what was going on in the world and ask her grandmother to reflect on that within her lifetime. And then she brought the Hardin County News. And Hardin County produced a newspaper once a week. And if they read a little bit out of the Hardin County News, at the end of the week they had the entire Hardin County News, and the granddaughter would ask her about different things and the families there. And then she brought her Bible, and then she would read to her grandmother from her Bible. One day I came to work, and you could just see it. I don't know how, but you could just see it. There was this cloud of oppression over this building, this huge cloud of oppression. And you could just feel it. And I said, what's wrong? People said, well, you know Laura's granddaughter comes and visits every day? And I said, yeah. They said, well, yesterday she died. She was out in her yard playing with her two little kids, and she died. And she'd had some kind of heart defect or something, and she died. I mean, everyone in the world expected this 90-year-old woman to die at any time. But nobody expected this vibrant young mother of two to die. And I, you know, I didn't know what to say or to do, problem equals opportunity for leadership, and I didn't demonstrate any, I'll just tell you. For whatever reason that day, I knew the reason. I mean, I just found a reason not to pass the meeting. I found a reason, I'm a busy guy, I had a lot of things going on. I didn't have any words of wisdom for anybody. And I actually managed to get through the whole day that way, and was putting on my sport coat, getting ready to leave my office, and I looked over and I saw my little pocket testament sitting on my desk, and I thought about this stupid little speech I'd been giving to people. Find somebody who feels kind of down today and read a word of hope where hope might not exist. This is a gift from God. But a gift is only as good as you use it. And I thought, you're never going to be able to give that stupid little speech again. So I took off my coat, grabbed my little pocket testament, I went down to her room. The door was closed. I thought, great, the door's closed. She doesn't want any visitors. She doesn't want to see anybody, and I almost left. I knocked on the door. I heard her voice say, come in. I opened the door, and she was sitting in her chair. I went in and I sat down on the little hospital bed next to her, and I just managed to stumble and fumble my way around. I mean, I didn't have anything to say. I said, Laura, I bet you feel really bad today. Oh, yeah, I bet you do. That was good. Bright guy. I just didn't have anything to say. And then, so I said, Laura, I brought my Bible. And I wondered if there was anything in this that I could read that would bring you a sense of comfort or help. But I don't really know. And she said, Kent, you could. You could. Would you read Psalm 121 to me? Well, I got to be real honest. I didn't have a clue what Psalm 121 was, but I was just glad I had something, and I found it, I read it. I'll lift up my eyes unto the hills from whence cometh my strength. My strength cometh. My help cometh from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is thy keeper, the Lord is thy shade upon thy right hand. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. The Lord shall preserve thy going out, thy coming in, from this time forth and even forevermore. And then this 90-year-old lady proceeded to repeat Psalm 121 from heart. Look into the hills from whence cometh my strength. My strength cometh from the Lord. Goes through the psalm. I said, Laura, well, why would you have me read something to you that you know so well? And she said, Kent, I know where my strength comes from. I'm just a little worried about you today. You know, 28 years, my life has been kind of transformed by not so much anything I've ever done or any real choice I've ever made, but by the people around me who show remarkable love and understanding and tolerance. I have found nursing homes, frankly, to be a place of abundant life and fullness of life. So when I go to parties, I don't mind telling people what it is I do. Okay, I'll end kind of with the nursing home stories there. Just kind of throw it open to folks' own sense of stumbling into stuff you didn't ever mean to end up into. Folks who are still trying to stumble into stuff.
What had you thought you'd stumble into?
Well, I had the normal list. A professional golfer. rock band kind of, you know, leader. You know, it's a pretty typical list. You know, none of my talents seem to kind of work that way.
One of the problems that I am having, and a lot of people I know, is that there just seem to be too many choices of things that I really like the Luther or whoever's idea of the intersection. Vocation is the intersection of what we most love to do and what the world most needs, and that's really sort of my guiding thought. But there's so many things that the world needs, and there's so many things that I like to do, and it seems like we just have too many choices. It's too many different directions to go, and there's so much need out there that it's trying to choose among the many things that in this country we're educated, we have resources on the whole, we know that the world is a place full of needs, and it's a joy to help and to serve and to give. It still is the question of where to spend the time that we have, where God wants us to act, what God really wants us to choose.
Thoughts folks would have? That thought goes somewhat with some of the Frederick Buechner quote that the village has been using, which our calling is where our great gladness meets the world's greatest need. So, you know, from the individual point of discernment, it seems to be a sense of there are a lot of needs, but which of those needs do I somehow respond to and make my heart glad? I keep doing the nursing home thing, thinking I'm going to find that, and I keep coming back to, I show up there, it's the one place I feel loved, that I feel loved.
Well, some of it comes to the fact that, you know, God wants you, at least my interpretation from reading and searching, is that God wants you to be you, whoever you are, and to reflect Him in whatever you do. So we try to say, I need to be a great missionary. I need to go here and minister there. I need to whatever, rather than understanding you need to simply live your life reflecting God in it. And by doing so, everyone you come into contact with, as you have in the nursing home, basically starts to form what your life will be. So often we spend so much of our life not doing anything, waiting to find out what it is we're supposed to do. And we miss the boat, in that sense.
I have to build on what you were just saying, because probably one of the most pivotal things in my life was at the point that I was finishing college, and I was truly in this crisis of uncertainty. And I was always stewing, and my friends were getting really tired and like stewing about, well, should I go to graduate school, or should I go be a volunteer, or should I do this? And I had a friend of mine, a couple friends were over, and we were talking about what was going to happen that fall, and I was doing my, you know, I could do this, I could do that, etc. And I'll never forget this one young woman, what were we, maybe 21, and she looked at me and she paraphrased Rhett Butler, and she said, frankly, my dear, God doesn't give a damn what you do. And I was totally, I mean, she spoke right to my heart, because what in fact I was doing was not taking responsibility for my life, thinking that somewhere along the line I'd get some tremendous insight. I'd be summoned, as is our theme. And one of the phrases you used that I really liked was about you made a lot of mistakes. There is this, you sort of, as you jump in, probably, I don't know if this is the right thing, But one thing leads to another, and you can look back and see kind of a pattern of God building on all of these experiences in a way that you would never at the start have said, this is where I'm going.
And I think of my most inspirational Christian friends, you know, people who, there's no question in my mind, God is in their life, and they live their life for God in that sense. If you look at them, I mean, they're very happy people, first of all. They're very happy people. They don't have trials, they don't have troubles, they don't have heartache and pain and all the rest, but as a whole, they're very happy people inside and somewhat secure, you know, secure. And you want to be with them because that happiness radiates. And it's whether they're cooking dinner for 14 or it's whether they happen to be going shopping, there's always somewhere God is the influence and it comes out in your life. Without beating over the head with evangelism or anything like that. It's just so inner in your core. And eventually they have found their careers the same way. But just constantly growing, if you will. That's harder to do than it sounds.
What are the thoughts, comments folks have? Any nursing home administrators in the room?
Heading to the nursing home?
Anybody want to be one?
I worked in a nursing home.
And was that a good experience?
Oh, yeah.
We've adopted, people have value statements. We actually have commitment statements. And the last commitment statement for us is that we're committed to recognizing all people as both givers and receivers of love. One of the things that institutions do poorly, especially in nursing homes, is take away the ability of people to be givers of love. You know, we were so good at doing everything for everybody. We've actually adopted this, what's called the Eden philosophy. It's not rocket science, but we filled our nursing home full of first of all, live plants. Live plants. We try to have a live plant in every room. The goal is that the residents care for the plant, because what so makes us human is our ability to care for others. To care for creation, care for, so we've taken that away. We have a rabbit that runs around, and I don't know if you all know this, but you can train a rabbit just like a cat to go to a rabbit box. But it took a long time to train this rabbit to go to the rabbit box, so there'd be rabbit droppings all the way down. And the goal would be to get the residents to clean up the rabbit droppings. For them to, you know, to care for this rabbit. We have lots of cats. Go and curl up with people on their beds. We have lots of birds. I think we probably have 500-600 birds. Mm-hmm. And anybody that wants a bird can have a bird in their room. There's this great story of that. This is kind of lives this out. Because once we did that, then we put this 90-kid child daycare center in the middle of our nursing home. And then we lost control. Yeah. You had your dogs, your cats, your rabbits, your birds, and then these 90-year-old kids. And there was this woman that had this bird, and the more she cared for this bird, the brighter she became. And it became a little thing. It's like a request to go to the beauty shop. She hadn't been to the beauty shop in years. She's caring for this bird. A request to now get the daily Billings Gazette paper so that she can read it. And she loved this bird. She had great stories about this bird. She'd say, you know, my bird has terrible TV habits. What do you mean he has bad TV habits? Well, he really likes to watch Jerry Springer. here's what. A cat gets in, knocks over the bird cage, door pops open, cat kills bird. We have death at nursing home. It was like, oh boy, gee whiz, you know. But, you know, what we said was, you know, that's life. This is life. This is what goes on in life. And this lady, in her wisdom, says, don't take it out on the cat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of our pastors had to go in the day room. We invited friends and family. We had a big funeral for the bird. But then it ended up that this lady cared for him. I guess the cat kept going in the room because thinking maybe there might be another bird. But the lady adopted the cat. And so that's kind of allowing people to kind of care for others. The important lesson for me to learn, took me a long time, is that cleanliness is not next to godliness. So if you ever come to visit my nursing home, it's not the cleanest nursing home you've ever been in. But when you put 90 kids and 500 birds and cats and rabbits and dogs, you know, cleanliness ain't what matters to us anymore. It's this care, this recognizing that all people are givers and receivers of love. Okay, thank you for indulging me and letting me tell you my nursing home stories. And I just appreciate you all coming here. Have a great day.